actually what Masoud had told us. Unit commanders and higher-ranking officers were assembled and scolded as to why they were sitting idle while they were witnessing many of the members performing self-immolations in Europe and elsewhere in the protest. Although I was upset that Mariam had betrayed us and left us, my sense of loyalty was strong, and I volunteered to take part in self-immolation.
زنانی بودن که از بیمارستان می اومدن و بچه‌ها می رفتن.
There were women who would return from hospital and were said to have undergone an operation called the feminine operation.
افراد اول که شما به خاطر
They would encourage women to undergo this surgery, saying that for instance you have kidney problems or that you have anemia. They'd remove their uterus and ovaries so they could no longer hope of having a family in the future.
We would take part in sessions in which everyone had to insult one another. Cursing. I remember the first time I took part in these sessions monitored by Pari Bakhshoi. We were told everyone should confess to the things they had done. Some people stood up and talked. People had to fabricate lies in the sessions so as not to suffer consequences later. One of the guys stood up and said, I took part in a private talk, meaning that he had had a chat with someone about something about the issues of the organization. It was then that I felt for the first time that these ceremonies made me feel nothing. This was the first spark that later convinced me to escape. But at that time, I still liked Masoud. I could see the wrong and ridiculousness, but I would think that perhaps Masoud and Mariam don't know what's going on here.
I was forcibly taken to a 150-member meeting of the women of the Leadership Council. As I was resisting sitting on that chair, because I refused to sit on that chair, they pushed me down and pulled my hands down. There was a woman who kept pushing me down on the chair so that I would sit calmly and listen to the speeches.
درد گردنم شدید بود قبلشم گوشم پرده گوشم از سمت چپ پاره شده بود
I had a really bad pain in my neck Prior to that my left eardrum had been torn They hadn't taken me to an Iraqi specialist
دکتر عراقی منو نبرده بودن یعنی دکتر متخصص
I was taken to one of the ordinary GPs of the organization and my simple ear infection turned into a torn eardrum
گوش درد ساده باعث شد پرده گوشم پاره بشه
Then they did what they shouldn't have and carried out an ear irrigation. And that's when the infection entered my internal ear.
اینا همینطوری چرک و عفونت از گوشم می‌ریخت. دکترها خود اونا هم گفته بودن باید بری دکتر.
Even their own doctors said that I should go to an Iraqi doctor and they knew that my ear needed an operation.
من یه پنبه تو گوشم گذاشتم.
I had put a piece of cotton wool in my ear so that the screams and cheers of the people in the meeting wouldn't hurt me so much.
تو جلسه اینها انجام میدن کمتر اذیت بشه گوشم. در اونجا یکی از این خانم‌ها
There was one woman who was provoked by the higher-ups and who was actually one of the torturers by the name of Faize Mohabbat Kar. She pulled the cotton wool out of my ear and shouted in it, What kind of a sick person are you for resisting so much?
One of the members said, I don't want to talk. Masoud Rajavi loudly shouted, Who the hell are you to decide? And some other words. This was the first time I was hearing such words from him. He shouted some curse words. The whole gathering was dead silent out of fear.
It had been years since we had had news of our families, for instance, our mothers and fathers. We weren't given news of them. They said that you should give a written guarantee that you would no longer rest in sleeping quarters and that you would no longer think about anything but Masood and Maryam. They said that your goals and dreams should be Masood and Maryam only, and that your leader is Masood Rajavi. You should direct all your affections towards Maryam and Masood Rajavi. To win our hearts and to deceive the women, Masood Rajavi presented the women of the Leadership Council and the trial members of the council with a gold necklace with a pendant with his image carved into it. He said, "Wear this to remember me all the time. You should have me in your hearts and you should give me your affection."
Just a few days after my back operation, I was ordered to take part in a campaign meeting. I told them that I'm still hospitalized, but that wasn't a good enough reason for them. I attended, but after a quarter of an hour, I fell sick and I was allowed to leave. This was the type of torture, the kind of which I haven't seen elsewhere. To force you to attend in a mental torture session while you are being physically tortured as well.
We, the women, were even afraid to go in front of the mirror in each other's presence. If one of them saw us looking in the mirror, they might even report us to the authorities, saying that she is seen in front of the mirror a lot. And why would they care about that? Well, because if we cared about our looks, it meant we cared about our future. And if we thought about our future, then that meant that we wanted to leave the organization someday.
We went there with a certain motivation. Our intentions were not bad per se. We were thinking that with their beautiful slogans, we were going to serve our country. And with the religious ideologies that we had, we were under the impression that we were walking along the same path and in the same direction as such historical heroes as Bagher Khan, Sattar Khan, Amir Kabir, and Mirza Kuchak Khan, and Dr. Mossadegh. Only the passage of time made it clear that the fight of Masood Rajavi was not for the freedom of the people, but rather for power. This is what Maryam herself confessed in one of the meetings. So it's not something I'm making up. Maryam said that it was Masood's right to become the leader of Iran and not Ayatollah Khomeini.
The Red Cross came to visit the camp. We were briefed and told that we were to tell the Red Cross reps that the Islamic Republic tortured our families. The person who was in charge of me by that time was familiar with my defiant nature. She came to me and she sympathized with my pains and ailments a little, but in fact she was keeping me under her watchful eye during the meeting.
According to the 4th Geneva Convention, we were considered protected citizens. When they wanted to announce this, they set up a general gathering and there we got to see and mix with our other friends. We mentioned our escape plans. First we wanted to escape 2 days after, but then decided to do it on the third day because we were worried they would keep us busy with meetings and gatherings of some sort. It was there that I made my final decision and said yes. We made plans to meet next to the podium, which was next to the driveway where Masood and Maryam took position during the parades and speeches. The driveway would lead to where Americans were deployed in Ashraf since the occupation.
My commander called me into her room. I refused to go, saying that now in this critical situation when I was going to meet the Red Cross reps, they were calling me into a room. No way. I had noticed that they were frightened I would do or say something, so they decided to remove me from the situation. They couldn't take me away forcefully in front of the Red Cross reps.
We all got into a car and drove towards the Americans, all the while fearing that they might catch up to us. We reached the Americans and they took us in. I should also point out that the place the Americans had dedicated to those who had separated from the MKO was not a nice place. It was like a detention center. Prior to that, we had heard many horrible things about this place from Mujahideen, saying that this place is horrendous and that people get killed or raped in order to deter us. But we had got to the point that we could no longer take any more of their lies, and we knew that remaining there any longer was a sin.
Zohra Qaimi said, wrap up the session. As they wanted to finish the meeting, I raised my hand and said that I wanted to talk. I had made up my mind to leave the organization, and now was my best chance for me to talk with the Red Cross reps. By this time, the women of the Leadership Council started throwing around the chairs, and they caused such a chaos that none of us could say anything to the representatives of the Red Cross.
Three months prior to this, the Americans had already interviewed us. I had already told them that I wanted to leave the organization and Ashraf. By then, they all knew because so many had requested the same. They would ask, do you want to stay in Iraq or go to the U.S.? And they said that they would help us reach our desired country in a few months' time.
They caused chaos to distract the Red Cross representatives and then to take me away from the venue. But I moved towards them. One of the Red Cross members even stretched her hand out, trying to protect me, and I managed to reach her.
At that time, they had managed to make a pact with the Americans, threatening that if they took us away, it would be bad for both sides, because the MKO was providing the Americans with needed intelligence. They claimed it would be bad for them because we would give their intelligence to the insurgents fighting against the Americans.
The Red Cross representative sat me down on a chair. I whispered to her, please take me out of here with you. They have tortured me and have taken me to many torture sessions. And now if you don't take me with you, I will have no chance. They have some sedative injections that they will apply to my neck. They will make me unconscious, and I'm sure they will then kill me.
When we thought we had finally been freed, we ended up in the custody of people who were being served by the MKO. However, we still preferred this to being involved with the Mujahideen.
They told me not to worry, and that now that I had talked to them, I was safe. And they told me they would return to talk to me more extensively the day after, because at that time the session had already come to a close. I begged them to take me with them, but they said they couldn't do that.
In 2007, the Americans at last allowed us to leave there in groups of five. And finally, we were set free to go and live our lives in the outside world. It had been years that I wanted to walk on the streets of a city. When, after 22 years, I could walk for the first time on the open streets and on the pavements and asphalt of somewhere that was not a closure, I had a strange feeling. It was euphoric.
I had two doctor's appointments, one for my ear and one with an orthopedist. Although the doctor's offices were in an Iraqi neighborhood, the organization had the situation completely under their control. I told myself, Zahra, you either die here or you have to escape. You cannot return to Ashraf camp alive. I went to the kitchen and saw that the windows were closed, sealed in a way that they could not be opened in any manner. They had become suspicious of my behavior. They asked me to join them and sit down on a chair. I did as I was told because I knew that escaping was out of the question. Then I was called in for my appointment. I took my ear file and entered the Iraqi doctor's office. My interpreter there was a woman who was among the women of the leadership council. All the while, I was analyzing the situation in my mind to see how I could take advantage of the slightest opportunity if it presented itself. They wanted to make the situation seem normal, so they called out, "Let's go." But then, as they turned their back on me, all this happened in a matter of seconds. I opened the back door and ran out.
During the first days that I was out, I still had this feeling that I shouldn't be thinking about my life and finding love. I was now away from the cult, but was still thinking that I was not entitled to these things. Neither Maryam Rajavi nor any other power can ever hold some people in a closed environment. Masud Rajavi used to say this himself, and now we should remind him of it again. He used to say, "No power can keep people in chains forever." Well, we should tell him the same thing now. No matter what you do, people who want to will get out one day. One day the chains will break off and the doors will open up. I wish you would stop all your cruelties and corruption and deceit, at least against your own people, and let them come out and see the world for themselves to finally realize that what you had inflicted upon them were lies. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Recently, French President Emmanuel Macron has expressed his dissatisfaction with the US on multiple occasions. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Global Times wrote, earlier this month, Macron criticized the US for selling energy and gas to Europe at four times the price the US sells to its own industry. Macron said, that is not exactly the meaning of friendship. He then reminded US President Joe Biden to speak with prudence when commenting on the risk of nuclear conflict. During a press conference following the just-concluded EU summit in Brussels, Macron again called out U.S. double standards over selling gas to Europe at prices 3 to 4 times higher than it is sold in U.S. domestic markets. TFI Global, an India-based media outlet, published an article on October 18th entitled, Forget U.S.-Russia, a Cold War is underway between France and the U.S. While the West is trying hard to portray its unity amid the Russia-Ukraine crisis, France is apparently not safeguarding the US prestige. This exposes deep contradictions in the transatlantic relationship. On the one hand, the practical interests of Europe and the US are in growing conflict. Due to the Russia-Ukraine crisis, global energy prices are rising sharply. Costly energy imports have pushed the Eurozone into growing trade deficit. Worse, the U.S. Federal Reserve continues to raise interest rates, bringing huge pressure to the European Central Bank when it comes to policy adjustment. The euro has fallen below parity with the dollar, dividing to its lowest level in 20 years and ending a 1-to-1 exchange rate with the U.S. currency. On the other hand, the strategic goals of the EU and the US are not the same. The US is ganging up with its allies to safeguard its hegemony. This is not the ambition of the EU. The latter wishes to shape its foreign policy based on its own interest, rather than being forced to take sides in major power competition. This is the main driving force for Macron to stress Europe's strategic autonomy time and again. However, as the Ukraine conflict drags on, Europe is propelled to increase its reliance on the US-led NATO and has to sacrifice its economic interest in exchange for security guarantees. Europe seems to have no alternative but to allow the US to continuously impose the cost of Ukraine-Russia crisis onto itself, and its own strategic autonomy has been greatly jeopardized. In particular, the U.S. is relentlessly provoking the escalation of the Ukraine crisis, which has not only weakened Russia, but also strengthened the U.S. control over Europe. This has put Europe in greater economic difficulties, as well as on the brink of a more dangerous war. Behind Macron's warning to the U.S., there are not only great worries about the intensification of future crises, but also helplessness that he cannot control the destiny of France, as well as a strong call for Europe to strengthen unity. Of course, France has its own reasons for playing the role as an anti-US fighter. France has a tradition of great power autonomy. It always has a global perspective, the importance of which cannot be overlooked. Former French President Charles de Gaulle had advocated France should adhere to an independent foreign policy and should not be completely constrained by the Western camp led by the US. For this reason, France once decided to withdraw from NATO's integrated military command, and it became the first Western major power to establish diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China. Moreover, France has been an advocate for European integration. The rise of Germany's strength, as well as the European debt crisis, once gave Germany the chance to lead Europe. After former German Chancellor Angela Merkel left politics, it gave France the opportunity to try to dominate European internal and foreign policies. In addition, Macron has his own political needs to take care of. Macron has regarded the revival of France as his own responsibility, promoting reforms internally and striving for France's status as a great power externally. In this year's presidential election, he was re-elected, but failed to gain an absolute advantage in the parliament. The domestic reform agenda was limited by the obstruction of the opposition. Therefore, Macron needs to make some breakthroughs in European integration and other diplomatic issues in order to strengthen his rule. The contradiction between France and the US, or between Europe and the US, is more of a contradiction in the Western camp and the result of uneven distribution of power and interest. However, France's disappointment toward the US has a limited impact. It will not change the dominant subordinate structure between the US and Europe, nor will it deal a fundamental blow to the hegemonic system of the US. It is impossible for France to give up the institutional dividends of the West either. But Macron's dissatisfaction toward the US will more or less bring some variables to transatlantic relations. For example, when the US-EU Trade Technology Council TTC meeting is held in September, the two sides will find it more difficult to coordinate with each other. In addition, when Europe and the US have a trade conflict in the field of electric vehicles, Germany will definitely stand on the side of France. It means the deepening differences between France and Germany will be breached, and Europe will form a tougher stance towards the US. The issues that seem to be problems only between the US and Europe could also add uncertainties to the current increasingly complex relationship among more major powers. According to Bloomberg, Macron said US trade and energy policies has created a double standard, and Europe was left paying higher prices for its natural gas, according to a report by oilprice.com. The comments from Macron come following 2 weeks of protest staged by workers in French oil refineries Total Energies and ExxonMobil. France was the latest country to withdraw from the Energy Charter Treaty, ECT. It has now switched to being a net importer of energy from once being a net exporter of energy. There are strikes reported at EDF's nuclear reactors as well. Macron is unhappy with the price it is paying for the liquefied natural gas LNG France is importing from the US. It turned to the US for LNG to make up for its declining nuclear fleet and also for the total halt of the Russian energy supplies. Bloomberg added the oilprice.com report revealed that U.S. natural gas exports to France increased 421% during the first 8 months of 2022. But LNG prices are soaring, an increase by 1,094% in August alone. In Brussels, Macron said that the North American economy is making choices for the sake of attractiveness, which creates a double standard. He pointed out that at home, the U.S. enjoys low energy prices, but exports energy at higher prices. He also pointed out that state aid for some sectors goes up to 80%, while state aid is prohibited under the Treaty on the Functioning of the EU, TFEU. Macron earlier this week referred to both the U.S. and Norway and said some nations are reaping the real super profits from geopolitical war unearned income. Macron's recent comments also reflect the troubles that are arising between France and the U.S. The ties are strained over the AUKUS deal, where the U.S., the U.K. and Australia formed a grouping, and the U.S. said it would provide Australia with 8 conventionally armed but nuclear-powered submarines. Australia earlier had a pact with France with respect to nuclear-powered submarines. Macron is expected to visit the United States in December and will take up the subject of energy with his American counterpart, Joe Biden.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
It's been described as a blow to Scotland's bid for independence from the United Kingdom. The attempt has hit a roadblock following a ruling by Britain's top court. The Supreme Court has said the Scottish government does not reserve the right to hold a second referendum on whether to break from the UK without permission from London. It says the laws that created the Scottish Parliament in 1999 do not have the power to legislate on areas of the Constitution. That includes the union between Scotland and England.
For all these reasons, which are set out more fully in the judgment, the court unanimously concludes that the proposed bill does relate to reserved matters. Accordingly, in the absence of any modification of the definition of reserved matters by an order in council under section 30 of the Scotland Act or otherwise, the Scottish Parliament does not have the power to legislate for a referendum on Scottish independence.
The Scottish National Party was trying to force a vote next October, as it did not have the approval of Britain's Parliament. The British Prime Minister has welcomed the court's decision, describing it as clear and definitive to move on from the independence debate.
Well, Mr. Speaker, let me start by saying we respect the clear and definitive ruling of the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom. And what I would say to the Honourable Gentleman, that firstly, I am looking forward to also seeing the moderator of Scotland tomorrow. And I think that the people of Scotland want us to be working on fixing the major challenges that we collectively face, whether that's the economy, supporting the NHS, or indeed supporting Ukraine.
But Scotland's First Minister has strongly criticised the move, saying that democracy is threatened. Nicola Sturgeon accused the British government, quote, outright democracy denial.
My expectation, in the short term at least, is that the UK government will maintain its position of outright democracy denial. That position is, in my view, not just unsustainable, it is also utterly self-defeating.
The decision by Britain's top court has triggered an angry response from the Scottish people. They have held a protest to slam the decision and to demand a second referendum to secede from Britain. Opinion polls suggest that Scots remain narrowly divided on whether to break from the UK and that a clear consensus in either direction has yet to emerge. England and Scotland have been joined in a political union since 1707, but ever since then, there have been demands by the Scottish people to secede from that union, which was imposed through a bloody war.
Scottish voters in our election last May elected a majority of MSPs who support having another referendum and indeed support independence. So the question goes back to the pro-union side is what are the rights of Scottish voters? What right to democracy or self-determination do they have?
Since 1999, Scotland has had a devolved government. That means a number of decisions are made by the Parliament in Edinburgh. However, many Scots believe that is not enough, and they want more power and say in the ways that Scotland is run. In September 2014, when Scottish voters were given the choice of staying in the UK or becoming an independent country, they backed staying in the UK by 55 to 45%. Independent supporters say Scotland needs to take its future into its own hands. They also argue that Scotland should no longer tie its future to the UK and its Conservative government. Scottish voters also voted heavily against Britain's exit from the European Union.
We must and we will find another democratic, lawful and constitutional means by which the Scottish people can express their will. In my view, that can only be an election. The next national election scheduled for Scotland is, of course, the UK general election, making that both the first and the most obvious opportunity to seek what I described back in June as a de facto referendum.
Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, has said her Scottish National Party would immediately seek to rejoin the bloc with Scotland as an independent country. Last month, the party published an economic prospectus arguing Scotland's economy would be stronger and fairer after independence.
Iran is stepping up its ante against the positions of separatist terrorist groups in Iraq's northern region. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has conducted a new round of drone and missile strikes against strongholds of hostile separatist terror groups in the semi-autonomous region of Kurdistan. According to reports, the IRGC ground force fired drones and missiles against positions of the so-called Kurdistan Freedom Party on the outskirts of Iraq's northern city of Kirkuk. The raids dealt a heavy blow to the separatist terror group. This is not the first time Iran pounds the positions of terror groups there. Since September 24th, the IRGC has frequently launched air raids against the positions of the terrorists who are holed up in Iraqi Kurdistan, seeking to ignite riots and unrest in Iran's western border cities. Iran has highlighted that its forces will continue their operations until threats being posed by the terrorists are eliminated and they are disarmed. Iranian military officials have also warned ordinary Iraqi people to evacuate areas close to the hideouts of separatist terrorists. Earlier, Iranian ambassador to Baghdad, Qasem Alisadegh, said Iran has told officials from Iraq's central government and the Kurdistan regional government that Tehran is serious about its national security after a number of sensitive Iranian military centers had been targeted from the Kurdistan soil. Iran has on countless occasions warned Iraqi Kurdistan's local authorities that it will not tolerate the presence and activity of terrorist groups along its northwestern borders, saying the country will give a decisive response should those areas become a hub of anti-Islamic Republic terrorists. Over recent weeks, Iran has witnessed foreign-backed riots in several of its cities. Terrorists have seized the opportunity to instigate unrest and insecurity in the country. Just recently, former U.S. National Security Advisor Bolton admitted that terrorists are being armed with weapons imported from Iraq's Kurdistan region. Bolton also confessed that he had seen images of Kurdish forces trained and armed in Iraq. Over the past weeks, Iranian security officials have seized large caches of weapons provided by foreign spy services at its borders. Riots broke out in Iran in mid-September after the death of Mahsa Amini. The 22-year-old fainted at the police station in Tehran and was pronounced dead 3 days later in hospital.
International Atomic Energy Agency has once again shown that it is acting on a political capacity rather than a technical one. The IAEA Board of Governors adopted an anti-Iran resolution despite Tehran's positive and constructive cooperation with the agency. Iran's foreign ministry says the politically motivated resolution was issued while Iran has the most transparent peaceful nuclear program in terms of the number of facilities under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency compared to other countries and the number of inspections its nuclear activities have undergone by the IAEA. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani stressed that the resolution was enforced after the U.S. and the three European countries, Britain, France, and Germany, exerted pressure on the agency's board of governors. Earlier, Kanani had said Iran took the first step in responding to the resolution. That came as director of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, said earlier in the day that the Islamic Republic will give a firm response to the anti-Iran resolution. Iranian officials have stated that Tehran won't bow to pressure and that Iran will continue its peaceful nuclear program in accordance with its needs and in compliance with its international obligations. Also, Iran's foreign ministry has earlier slammed the instrumental use of the international organizations against independent nations, saying that has become a norm of the foreign policy of Western countries. The resolution adopted on Thursday is the second resolution passed by IAEA this year, and calls on Tehran to fully cooperate with the agency's probe into uranium traces at three alleged undeclared sites in Iran. Tehran says the IAEA is basing its statements on information fabricated by Israel. Iran has started enriching uranium to the purity level of 60% at its Fordo nuclear facility following the recent resolution that the U.S. and the European Troika initiated at the UN Nuclear Agency's Board of Governors to mount pressure on the Islamic Republic. Tehran has informed the International Atomic Energy Agency of its decision via a letter. It described the move as a strong message to the recent anti-Iran resolution passed by the IAEA's Board of Governors. Iran also installed two new IR-2M and IR-4 cascades at the Natanz and Fordo facilities, which have now reached the stage prior to the injection of uranium gas into centrifuges. This means that Iran has practically imitated uranium enrichment by means of the new cascades, and the process will finish within the next few days. Moreover, Iran has fitted and launched new centrifuges at two empty holes in Fordo and Natanz nuclear sites, in what is deemed as a decisive response to the resolution against the country. The holes under Iran's commitment to the terms of the landmark 2015 nuclear deal, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, had been vacant, but centrifuges have been installed there once again. The report went on to point to the replacement of IR-1 centrifuges at Fordo with IR-6 as Iran's fourth important move against the IAEA resolution, stressing that the measures will increase enrichment at the site by 10 times. The latest measures are set to be in line with a law approved by the Iranian parliament to counter unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States on Tehran. The Iranian parliament passed the law, dubbed the Strategic Action Plan to Counter Sanctions, in December 2020, prompting the Iranian administration to restrict the IAEA's inspections and accelerate the development of the country's nuclear program beyond the limits set by the JCPOA. Iran took five steps in scaling back its obligations, among them abandoning operational limitations on its nuclear industry, including with regard to the capacity and level of uranium enrichment. All those measures were adopted after informing the IAEA beforehand, with the agency's inspectors present on the ground in Iran. Negotiators from nearly 200 countries at the COP27 UN Climate Summit in Egypt agreed to set up a loss and damage fund meant to help vulnerable countries cope with climate disasters. They also agreed the globe needs to cut greenhouse gas emissions nearly in half by 2030. The agreement also reaffirmed the goal of keeping global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. However, for the 27th time, the UN climate talks have failed to directly address the biggest driver of the climate crisis, the production of gas, oil, and coal. This is amid calls for the phase-out of all fossil fuels inside the conference walls and beyond. More than 80 countries had supported a proposal to phase down the use of fossil fuels at the UN Climate Summit. Ultimately, an attempt to address the biggest source of the planet warming emissions that are causing the climate crisis ended in a fiasco, as the participants only agreed to phase down polluting coal power and phase out inefficient fossil fuel subsidies. That's after a number of oil and gas producing nations, led by Saudi Arabia, blocked a key proposal to phase out all fossil fuels, not just coal. German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock said it is more than frustrating to see overdue steps on mitigation and the phase-out of fossil energies being stonewalled by a number of large emitters and oil producers. Addressing the summit, the European Union's climate chief, Frans Timmermans, said the EU was disappointed with the final outcome of the summit.
What we have in front of us is not enough of a step forward for people and planet. We should have done much more.
The UN chief, Antonio Guterres, reacted with saying that the COP27 climate talks had fallen short in pushing for the urgent, drastic carbon cutting needed to tackle global warming.
Our planet is still in the emergency room. We need to drastically reduce emissions now, and this is an issue this COP did not address.
Environmental campaigners labeled the COP27 summit as yet another monumental failure to tackle climate crisis. Activists blasted richer countries for not doing more to limit carbon emissions. They say the US, EU, UK, and others came to the summit with empty words, hollow promises, and the refusal to take responsibility for having set the planet on fire and destroying millions of lives and livelihoods. While the agreement to establish a loss and damage fund represents immense progress for vulnerable nations who have been calling for finance to address the impacts of climate change for many years, this win is bittersweet. The failure to address the root cause of loss and damage through agreeing to phase out oil, gas, and coal will mean more loss and damage in future. Currently, approximately 84% of the world's energy needs are met from the usage of fossil fuels, especially oil. In 2021, the world consumed nearly 490 exajoules of fossil fuels. That amounts to an unfathomable figure of epic proportions. The world is on track to produce more than double the fossil fuels that are compatible with a 1.5 degrees Celsius target. The fossil fuel industry is also earning 11-figure profits from this addiction, while households struggle to afford basic needs and over 1 billion people live with almost no modern energy. Africa alone is home to 600 million people without access to electricity. The US and China top in fossil fuel consumption. According to data, an average American consumes at least 23 barrels of petroleum every year. With billions of dollars invested every year into establishing wars, strengthening military and weaponry technologies by developed nations, they still have not come up with a concrete solution to end complete dependency on fossil fuels. Future changes are expected to include a warmer atmosphere, a warmer and more acidic ocean, higher sea levels, and larger changes in precipitation patterns. The extent of future climate change depends on what we do now to reduce greenhouse gases.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime forces and settlers have killed 140 Palestinians, including at least 30 children, in the West Bank this year, making it the deadliest on a monthly average for Palestinians since the UN began recording fatalities in 2005. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International noted, Mahmoud Abdul Jalil al-Saadi, 17, became the latest victim of Israeli regime barbarism when he was shot and killed on Monday, November 21st, by the occupation forces in Jenin. He was on his way to school when the trigger-happy Zionist occupiers shot him. Al-Saadi posed no threat to the Zionists, but they killed him anyway because they have no regard for Palestinian life. He became victim number 140 of Israeli regime brutality this year, making it the bloodiest year for Palestinians since 2005. He was shot in the abdomen during an Israeli regime raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. Five other Palestinians were wounded, according to Palestinian media reports. The boy was shot when Israeli regime army used live ammunition in a raid on Jenin. Al-Saadi was rushed to Ibn Sina Hospital, but he had lost a lot of blood and was pronounced dead a short while later. When the news of his death spread, people gathered outside the hospital and carried his body through the streets. The Zionist regime forces and settlers have intensified their murderous spree, killing 140 Palestinians, including at least 30 children, in the occupied West Bank this year. In August, in an act of their now routine barbarism, Israeli regime forces killed 49 Palestinians when they bombed the tiny Gaza Strip for 3 days. They bombed apartment buildings and hospitals, destroying them. These constitute two war crimes. A week earlier, on November 21st, Israeli regime occupation forces had shot and killed 15-year-old Fula Rasmi Al-Maslama in the West Bank town of Beituna. It was a day before her 16th birthday, the Palestinian Health Ministry said. Al-Maslama was shot in the head by Israeli regime troops during an army raid in Beituna, west of Ramallah. Another passenger in the car was wounded. As is now customary, the Zionist occupation forces refused medical help or allow her to be transported to hospital. She was held for 25 minutes after she was shot, bleeding to death. The Zionists alleged that the car had driven towards them when they were carrying out a raid at Beituna. Neither Al-Maslama nor the occupant in her car was aware of the presence of Israeli regime troops in the streets. The occupation forces did not fire warning shots to stop the car. Instead, they aimed their guns at the head of Al-Maslama. Faced with such barbarism and with no prospects of any peace, the Palestinians have started to fight back virtually with their bare hands. Resistance to Zionist occupation is the strongest in Jenin and Nablus. The Lion's Den has emerged as an independent force in Nablus fighting the Zionist occupiers. As a consequence of their heroic acts, they have killed 27 Israeli regime troops in the same period. While the Palestinians are no match for the heavily armed Zionist troops and illegal squatters, as known as settlers, time and history are on their side. They will ultimately triumph, inshallah. Meanwhile, the website of Middle East Eye wrote, a 17-year-old Palestinian student was killed by Israeli regime army while on his way to school on Monday, November 21st. Palestinian health officials have said Mahmoud Abdul Jalil al-Saadi, 17, was shot in the abdomen during an Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. Palestinian media reported that five others were wounded after a fire exchange erupted between fighters and Israeli regime troops. A civilian succumbed to critical wounds after he was hit by live Israeli occupation bullets in the abdomen in Jenin, the ministry said in a statement. The ministry said Saadi, a secondary student, was on his way to school when he was caught up in the violence, according to local media. He was admitted to the intensive care unit at a nearby hospital where he was later pronounced dead. Earlier, Israeli regime troops stormed the Al-Hadaf neighborhood of Jenin and surrounded the home of Rateb al-Baldi before arresting him. The Zionist regime army said it was seeking to arrest a fighting operative during the operation. During the activity, shots were fired and explosive devices were hurled at the soldiers, it said. The soldiers responded with live fire towards suspects who fired at them. A hit was identified. A large crowd gathered and carried Saadi's body through the streets of Jenin. His death comes amid a spike in the Zionist regime's violence against Palestinians in the West Bank this year and a resurgence of Palestinian resistance. Israeli regime forces and settlers have killed 140 Palestinians, including at least 30 children, in the West Bank this year, making it the deadliest on a monthly average for Palestinians since the UN began recording fatalities in 2005. A further 49 Palestinians were killed during an Israeli regime bombardment of Gaza in August. 27 Israeli civilians and troops have been killed by Palestinians in the same period, the highest number since 2008. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 200 settlements and outposts deemed illegal under international law across the West Bank and East Al-Quds.
Aperture. Welcome back to Aperture. We witnessed the spectacular and awe-inspiring natural beauty of the Kaluts or Yardangs in the western part of Dashtalut in Iran. Rising up to 80 meters, these streamlined ridges have been carved by the wind out of the clay and sand lining the desert floor, creating a magnificent array of high-rising sculptures and lying parallel to the prevailing winds. The Yardangs are some of the world's most prominent. Stay with us as we follow Javad Gharayi, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, as he introduces more of Iran's desert wonders to us.
Early the next morning, I was still sleepy and tired, but some of the most beautiful natural views revealed